1 Kings chapter 10. In chapter 9, we were looking at all the various building projects that Solomon had undertaken. Lots of different things that he had been building, and we were looking at all the wealth of his kingdom. And so the story goes on, talking about King Solomon and the glory days of Israel. Remember, we've talked about this. We've used this phrase many times now, the golden age of Israel. This is the zenith of Israel's glory during this time in Solomon's reign, during this period of time where Israel knows peace and there's great prosperity and they're experiencing all this blessing from the Lord. Now Solomon is, as king, now this is the time of Israel's heyday. Now we pick up here chapter 10. Let's read the first four verses here. It says, "Now when the queen of Sheba heard of the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, she came to test him with hard questions. She came to Jerusalem with a very great retinue, with camels that bore spices, very much gold and precious stones. And when she came to Solomon, she spoke with him about all that was in her heart. So Solomon answered all her questions. There was nothing so difficult for the king that he couldn't explain it to her. And when the queen of Sheba had seen all the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he had built," let's keep going, in verse 5, "and the food on his table, the seating of his servants, the service of his waiters and their apparel and his cupbearers, and his entryway by which he went up to the house of the Lord, there was no more spirit in her." All right. Sheba, who is this woman, the queen of Sheba? Modern scholars are kind of split between who they think this is. They either believe that this is, or where Sheba is. Some believe that it's modern-day Yemen in southern Arabia. Others believe it's possibly Ethiopia or Egypt. Josephus, who would be the oldest of the history writers there, identifies her as a queen of Egypt/Ethiopia. From what we know of it, I mean, based on just what we're reading here, this was a mighty wealthy kingdom with obviously a widespread commercial enterprise involved in it that was stretching from Syria to East Africa. And they were obviously famous for their gold and for their spices and the things that they provided for merchants that way. If she was coming from southern Arabia, from the region of Yemen, it would have been about a 1,500-mile trip for her. Again, we don't know exactly if that's where she was coming from. She could have been coming from Egypt, which would have been less of a trip. Many speculate that this was actually part of a trade delegation that was coming into Israel. Obviously, the fame of Israel is spreading now. The stories of her wealth and the wisdom of Solomon is present, and so people are wanting to open up opportunities for trade and commerce with Israel. But obviously, from the text, we see that she's motivated herself to come and see Solomon. She's trying to determine whether or not the stories are true in terms of the kind of wisdom that he supposedly has. Verse 1 states that he clearly is internationally famous. People are aware of who he is and his wisdom that he has. And her purpose in coming to Solomon, based on this text, is that she's coming to pose hard questions for him, which is a curious thing. You know, we look at that and we say, what questions? You know, what questions did she ask Solomon? We don't know. I mean, it's hard to imagine that, like, if she did come 1,500 miles, it's hard to imagine that, you know, she came to try to stump him with a math quiz or something or a story problem. You know, if Hiram had 200 pieces of gold and he gave 8 pieces of gold to... I can't imagine that that's what the whole thing is about, that she's doing that. But obviously, she's got something on her heart, she's got something on her mind that she wants some clarification for. She wants wisdom, then she wants to see a display of that wisdom. So it's a test in that she's wanting to see if this guy's really for real, if he's got this kind of ability to answer questions or not. And so that's what she does. The wording in verse 2 is interesting because it says that she spoke, and literally it means that she communed with him about what was on her heart. And that indicates something more than just a cerebral inquisitiveness. You know, it's hard to imagine that she's, when she's talking about issues of her heart, she's communing with him about those kinds of things. It's hard to imagine that we're just talking about surface scientific issues. I have a tendency to think here that this is something deeper than this. This could have been diplomatic questions. This could have been questions about how to rule. This could have been questions about ethics. It could have been questions about God and the nature of the world and the universe and everything. I mean, you never know. But either way, whatever her questions were, whatever these issues were that were weighing on her heart that she wanted to talk to Solomon about, you know, he was able to give and provide answers for her that clearly were significant in her thinking as she saw it. The answers were good to her. So let me reread verse 5. She's amazed by everything there. She's amazed by the food on his table. She's amazed at the seating of his servants. She's amazed at the service of his waiters and their apparel and his cupbearers and his entryway by which he went up into the house of the Lord. And then there was no more spirit in her. So, you know, the food, the waitstaff, the apparel, all of that was amazing. But when she sees the foyer, whoa, man, that's amazing. Nobody does up a foyer like Solomon. So she starts to faint. And actually, we're talking about the gateway there in towards the temple. And so, you know, something significant could be happening there. Something about this is overwhelming to her. When it says she had no more spirit in her, that just means that, you know, she's just overwhelmed by what it is she's seeing. As we keep going here, and then she spoke to the king, "It was a true report, which I heard in my own land about your words and your wisdom. However, I didn't believe the words until I came and saw with my own eyes, and indeed the half was not told me. Your wisdom and prosperity exceeded the fame of which I heard. Happy are your men, and happy are these servants, these your servants who stand continually before you and hear your wisdom. Blessed be the Lord your God, who delighted in you, setting you on the throne of Israel, because the Lord has loved Israel forever. Therefore he made you king to do justice and righteousness." So, the queen of Sheba, she's obviously grown up with wealth and splendor. I mean, obviously, she's coming from a country that's represented with gold and exotic spices and commerce, and yet she's overwhelmed by what she sees in Israel. And I think that as I look at this, I wonder, you know, what is it? I mean, obviously, Solomon has been building splendid buildings here, and obviously the architecture is something to behold, and his wealth is bringing in a lot of different things, but I still believe it has to be the presence of God there in the midst of this. I think it's significant that it's when she gets to the entryway to the temple that it says that she has no more spirit in her, that she's overwhelmed by what it is she's seeing. That's the presence of God that makes the distinction here. I mean, obviously all these other things are really cool. Waiters and clothes and all of this stuff is nice, but still, all in all, it's just so much stuff. I mean, a person who's had a lot in their lives, it's hard to impress them. It's hard to get them excited when they see something else. You know, they see something more. But I believe it's the idea there that God's presence in there and his wisdom is manifest through Solomon, that it makes it something else altogether. And she tells Solomon, you know, I heard the stories about this. I heard about this place. I heard about you, but I don't think I've heard the half of it. This is an amazing deal. This is amazing what you've done here. And then her statement here when she says, "Blessed be the Lord your God," in verse 9. Blessed be the Lord your God. It begs the question, you know, is this a confession of faith by the Queen of Sheba? Is she confessing a faith in God, the God of Israel? Is she converting to Judaism in this statement? And a lot of people have speculated that that would be true. You know, she does seem to have this experience here that connects it, at least her experience with the temple. You know, she's overwhelmed, I believe, by the presence of God, but the text doesn't say that specifically. But does this mean that here and in this moment she's giving her allegiance to him? It's hard to say. I mean, there's a huge amount of legend associated with this, and I mean a lot of legend concerning, you know, what went on. There was a really horrifying movie made back in the 50s with Yul Brynner in it where, you know, there was a big deal about this. But, I, you know, I don't know. I don't think that the text really gives us a definitive answer on this. I mean, when we look at it, for what the text is saying, she isn't saying anything that's actually any different really at all from what other dignitaries have said, you know, when they've talked to the Israelite kings. I mean, this is, you know, we saw Hiram say pretty much the same kind of thing over there in chapter 5. I mean, this could just be the polite way of acknowledging that Solomon's God, his God that he serves, has really done a lot of cool things. This really seems to be working for you, Solomon. So, you know, blessed be the Lord your God. And you notice that is the language there. Blessed be the Lord your God. That doesn't necessarily mean anything in and of itself. Like I said, I don't think we can definitively answer that question from the text and what's provided here for us. You know, Jesus in Matthew chapter 12, he mentions this meeting. He mentions this encounter. He's speaking words of judgment on Israel. He's condemning the nation of Israel at that moment because they're rejecting him as the Messiah. And he's saying to them that, you know, the Queen of Sheba is going to rise up on the day of judgment and condemn this generation. Now, you know, whether he's speaking metaphorically, whether he's speaking literally, we don't know. But, I mean, he's saying, in essence, that she came from a great distance. And that's what he says. She came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon. I'm telling you, one that's greater than Solomon is here right now. And so he's pointing towards her, kind of in a positive example. I mean, when you read that and you look at that, you come away thinking, you know, that he's using her as a positive example in the sense that she'll rise up in condemnation as a foreigner who recognized the wisdom of God and sought it out. But he could just be pointing towards, you know, her example of being a seeker. She comes a great distance. You know, she didn't let distance or cost or anything like that stand in the way of her searching these things out. And not, you know, not just a question. She comes a great distance, not just to question and probe there, but she also comes to learn, obviously. And clearly she does learn. That's what the text in First Kings indicates to us. And that's the thing that Jesus seems to be exalting in the Matthew 12 passage, that, you know, that's the attitude that he's saying exemplifies what it is he's looking for from those who come to them, people who are willing to seek him out to find the answers. Not just, you know, and that's the thing that we got to be careful of, and that our generation has to be careful of, that we don't come to Jesus saying, you know, what kind of answers can you give me? What kind of answer do you have for my life? But to actually find out what the right questions are. What is life really about, and who do you say that I am? So, but anyway, that's what Jesus seems to exalt here. And so she's used later on as a positive example. So does that mean she became a believer in God? I don't know. I really don't know, but legend indicates that she did, but you can't put any real stock in that. Verse 10, then she gave the king 120 talents of gold, spices in great quantity, and precious stones. There never again came such abundance of spices as the queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. Also, the ships of Hiram, which brought gold from Ophir, brought great quantities of almug wood and precious stones from Ophir. And the king made steps of the almug wood for the house of the Lord and for the king's house, also harps and stringed instruments for singers. There never again came such almug wood, nor has the like been seen to this day. Now King Solomon gave the queen of Sheba all she desired, whatever she asked, besides what Solomon had given her according to the royal generosity. So she turned and went to her own country, she and her servants. Okay, so the Queen of Sheba leaves a lot of parting gifts for Solomon after she's heading out. Millions of dollars worth of gold and a ton of spices. You know, everybody. McCormick spice racks were just everywhere in that time. And Solomon was giving them to all his employees as gifts at Christmas time. And it says that Israel would never again be this spicy. But it also says that Solomon was very generous with her in return. You know, she didn't leave empty-handed. It says that he gave her all that she desired above and beyond what royal protocol called for in that day. In other words, he was very generous with her anyway when she came, but then he gave her even more than that. Now, once again, we come to a place in this where legend seems to predominate a lot of people's thoughts, more so than necessarily the biblical text. There's just an abundance of legend concerning this encounter. Do these verses, and that's the question we have to ask, as we've read it so far, do these verses seem to indicate that there was some sort of romantic encounter between the king Solomon and the queen of Sheba? As we look at that, do we infer anything from this, that there was some sort of relationship developed from all of this? Now, legend says that the queen of Sheba went home with more than just parting gifts, but also went carrying Solomon's son. And the monarchy of Ethiopia to this very day, Ben and I were talking about that just last week, but the monarchy of Ethiopia to this very day say that they're tracing their heritage back to, their ancestry back to King Menelik, who is supposed to be Solomon's son by Sheba. But if we go to any kind of textual resources on this, there are no textual resources, I'm talking about within history, within legend, or anything like that, until the Middle Ages, until about the time of the rise of Islam. Before that, there's nothing. You don't find anything about this in the Talmud. You don't find any kind of indication that there's anything in like that. In none of the earlier midrashes of the rabbis do you ever find that. Now, after the Middle Ages, you find it. You actually find all kinds of apocryphal writings that indicate this kind of possibility. There are Arabic stories and texts that tell the story. And they're actually, the stories that they tell are pretty lurid, actually, in terms of, what went on here. I mean, it's, they tell these explicit tales of forbidden love that really, in a lot of ways, amount to date rape. But, I mean, it's a different culture or whatever. But, I mean, that's the whole way it's presented. Within the Arabic culture, you find it, like I said, within apocryphal writings of the Jewish writers after the Middle Ages. But we find nothing in antiquity. And if we go to Josephus, who would be the earliest writer of histories there, we never find any indication whatsoever that there was any kind of romantic connection between these two, or that there was any kind of progeny of Solomon from this. There's no mention of this affair anywhere. The Bible doesn't seem to indicate. I mean, as we look at this text, I mean, honestly, as we've read through it here, you're not going to infer anything. The closest you'd get is when he's saying he gave her all the desires of her, all that her heart desired or whatever like that. But even there, I mean, that's dangerous ground to start inferring from that a romantic connection, because boy, oh boy, you could just do that with all kinds of people within the Bible if you use that kind of a loose connection. So, I mean, so here's an interesting thing, and here's an interesting theory that I was looking at, and there's actually a book that's recently been published about this. There's an interesting point as to why the Middle Ages becomes the starting point for these kind of stories. The Bible is representing something here that's very unusual, if you think about it. What the biblical text is presenting to us is a woman who is obviously a strong woman, obviously a woman in authority, and clearly a woman of intellectual prowess who commands a great deal of wealth. This did not fit well within a misogynistic worldview that didn't allow for women to have that kind of place or position within society. And during the rise of the Middle Ages, in order to maintain a certain level of control, different aspects of the story were altered and changed, so that by the time you get to the Yul Brynner movie, this woman, who clearly came with a great deal of dignity and intellect and to Solomon, is portrayed as some sort of pagan, hussy who just is dancing around and all this stuff. I mean, it's a weird thing. And as you think about it, the possibilities of that, to me, seem rather intriguing, that it could very well be. You know, the Bible doesn't represent this in any other way than to represent that this is a woman who clearly had authority, had a position in life that other women obviously weren't enjoying at that time, and points that out. Actually, as far as we can tell, it leaves it in a positive light. I think, I don't know. Anyway, I think it's an interesting theory to wonder how it is that she went from being this intelligent woman of nobility to being some sort of barefoot and pregnant lady leaving Israel after her meetup with Solomon. There's actually recent archaeological discoveries. Well, not necessarily so much discoveries, but challenges to the concept of who this woman may have been. As recently as within a couple years ago, archaeologists are beginning to wonder if they've actually misrepresented the dates of the different dynasties in Egypt, the different pharaoh dynasties. They're wondering if actually they may be off by centuries based on, and I can't go into the whole thing and because I'm not even sure I follow it. But the point is that there was a queen in Egypt that could easily have fit the description of who this is. I got her name here, Hatshepsut. And she was in the wrong time period based on the former understanding of the chronology of the Egyptian kings. But if the reordering of this chronology is correct, then it actually puts her in the right time frame, which is an interesting thing because the histories of this queen, she's this singular queen who rose up to power, ruled for 22 years in Egypt with great wealth and enjoyed a great deal of power, which was unusual for that time period. And she's known and famous for an expedition that she led to a mysterious place called Punt, which she referred to as the land of God. And when she went there, she returned, according to the hieroglyphic things, she returned with a great deal of unusual things, strange flora and odd-looking creatures, and monkeys are associated with it. Now, for years, they looked at that and said, well, it had to be this Punt, this magical place of Punt, had to be somewhere in Africa, because that's where you're going to find these kinds of creatures associated with that area. But we're going to actually find out that monkeys weren't only in Africa at that time because of the wealth that Solomon had. So, I mean, I think that there's an interesting possibility there. There's a possibility that maybe she was Egyptian. Maybe this really does come. Maybe Josephus, way back in antiquity, had it right. She was a queen of Egypt and Ethiopia. In fact, why would we think that Josephus would be wrong when he was so close to the time period? Okay. And you're saying, okay, can we get on with it, Rob? Yes, we can. Verse 14. The weight of gold that came to Solomon yearly was 666 talents of gold. Whoa, wait a minute. What? The weight of gold that came to Solomon yearly was 666 talents of gold. Besides that, from the traveling merchants and the income of the traders, from all the kings of Arabia and the governors of the country. The yearly income, the base salary for Solomon as king, when he'd get his W-2 every year, what was typed in to the line under net income for your base income was 666. How curious is that? Now, you know me that I am totally not into numerological stuff. I mean, you know, the theories just run the gamut of, you know, what all this means or what all that means or what, you know, they're going to implant this or that or whatever, 666. But it's weird, isn't it? I mean, don't you think it's a little weird that this number pops up like this? Do you know this is the only other place, apart from Revelation 13, that this number ever appears in Scripture? Well, this and the correlating passage in 1 Chronicles chapter 9. But it's the exact same thing. The yearly salary for King Solomon was 666 talents of gold a year. What does that mean? I mean, why is that there? Is there a connection there? Is there a connection between this and chapter 13 of Revelation, where John on the Isle of Patmos is forecasting the rise of a ruler, the rise of someone, a beast, he refers to him as, a ruler who we've always identified as the Antichrist, who John says at that time, whoever has wisdom, let him understand this, and that you're not gonna be able to buy or sell or do any kind of trade or commerce without having the number of his name, without having the mark of his name or the number of his name. And the number is the number of a man, and the number is 666. I don't know. I mean, I think that's weird. I mean, Revelation 13 connects that number with commerce. And right here, that number is connected with commerce. Now, we could just look at that and say, well, yeah, it's just saying that Solomon had a lot of gold. And he did. He did have a lot of gold. And that's true. And that's what we could walk away from this passage saying, yeah, Solomon had a lot of gold. But why that number? I mean, why? It never appears again. Why that number? Why 666 talents of gold? John surely had to know this passage was there. When he's writing out the revelation and he's seeing these things, he surely had to know that this passage was here and that number was here. I don't know. I think it's really curious. I mean, from this point on in Solomon's story, Solomon is going to slide into oblivion. Great apostasy takes place in the land of Israel. The glory days are gone from this moment on. From this passage on, everything changes, and the glory days are gone. It's curious to me. It's, you know, it seems weird to me. It sits there so obvious, so glaring, and yet I have no idea what to make of it. It's one of those things. I John in Revelation 13 says, whoever has ears to hear, let him hear. And I guess I don't have those ears because I can't make the connection. I don't know what it is, but it's too weird to me that it sits here like this in 1 Kings. A king known for his wisdom. And Revelation 13, John says, whoever has wisdom, let him understand. It's connected with commerce, and here it's connected with commerce. It's too weird, but I don't know. You know, maybe those ears here are only going to be for those who get closer to the time, who get right there into the mix of the thing, and then they have the ears. Or when you think about messianic prophecies in the Old Testament, I mean, there were a lot of them. I mean, explicit ones. You couldn't get much more explicit than Isaiah 53. You couldn't get much more explicit than Psalm 22. Messianic prophecies, and yet not a single person came up to Jesus and said, I got it figured out. I know who you are. I put all those prophecies together and I got it. I know it. I get it now. All of them were interpreted in hindsight. All of them became points of reference to look back and verify your findings when the revelation is unfolded, when the mystery is finally revealed. Maybe this stuff, maybe these numbers, maybe all this stuff isn't necessarily a mystery for us to solve beforehand. Maybe it's something that we'll be able to look back on, these prophecies, these apocalyptic concepts, to look back on and verify. Oh, I get it now. Now I see what it was he was trying to say. Now this makes sense. Now I know where we are. I don't know. All I know is this. While that kind of stuff is really cool and fascinating and everybody got real quiet and I got everybody's attention for a moment here, it still is not the majority of what the Bible is all about. The Bible is about me waking up in the morning and loving my family and being kind to my wife and setting my hands to do the work that God's given me to do and doing it with all of my heart and living consistently between my inner life and my outer life in harmony with who God is. That's what the biblical revelation's about. Day by day, living out the reality of God's presence in my life and his kingdom manifest here on earth through his church. And so, you know, these numbers are fascinating, and it's really cool stuff to think about, and there's nothing wrong with thinking about it and puzzling it over. I got no answers for you. I wish I did. I hope I didn't have you building up towards, oh boy, he's going to tell us what it means, because I don't have a clue. But I think it's interesting, and I think it's awesome that God's in control of the whole deal, so that thousands of years before John writes down this prophecy about a mysterious ruler who will have the number of a man, the scriptural text has already laid it out. There's something there. There's something about it. There's something there. So we have a... I'll tell you what, Rocky, we'll get to it in a minute. I'm going to do... We'll do questions and answers at the end of it. Okay, remember it. Keep it in mind, and we'll get to it at the question things. That's cool. No, you're good. So anyway, the rest of the verses that we're going to look at, let's pick up here in verse 14. We'll wrap up here. The weight of the gold that came to Solomon, I already said that, didn't I? 15, verse 16, that's what I'm looking for, I'm sorry. King Solomon made 200 large shields of hammered gold, 600 shekels of gold went into each shield. He also made 300 shields of hammered gold, three minas of gold went into each shield. And the king put them in the house of the forests of Lebanon. Moreover, Remember that house, remember the building that's got all the huge cedar trees from Lebanon that are pillars through it so that it looks, that may have looked like a forest? That's where all the shields are now hanging. Moreover, the king made a great throne of ivory and overlaid it with pure gold. The throne had six steps to the top of the throne, and the top of the throne was round at the back. There were armrests on either side of the place of the seat, and two lions stood beside the armrest. 12 lions stood there, one on each side of the six steps. Nothing like this had been made for any other kingdom. All King Solomon's drinking vessels were gold, and all the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were pure gold. Not one was silver, for this was accounted as nothing in the days of Solomon. For the king had merchant ships at sea with the fleet of Hiram. Once every 3 years, the merchant ships came bringing gold, silver, ivory, apes, and monkeys. Because Solomon knew the fun never starts until you have a monkey. So King Solomon surpassed all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom. Now all the earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put on his heart. Each man brought his present, articles of silver and gold, garments, armor, spices, horses, and mules at a set rate year by year. And Solomon gathered chariots and horsemen. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horsemen whom he stationed in the chariot cities with the king at Jerusalem. The king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stones, and he made cedar trees as abundant as the sycamores, which are of the lowland. And also Solomon had horses imported from Egypt and Keva. The king's merchants bought them in Keva at the current price. Just real quick, here's all this example of the great extravagance of Solomon. You know, one of the things is Solomon asked for wisdom, and God said, "You didn't ask for wealth, and so I'm going to give you wealth because you didn't ask for wealth. You asked for wisdom to do something good." But the wealth that God is giving him, Solomon, as we see from this text, is out multiplying that. He's actually increasing that. We're going into realms of extravagance. You would have never seen golden shields in David's kingdom. I mean, gold was a worthless thing to make a shield out of. Gold is way too heavy and way too soft. Nobody's going to use that for real combat. That's for show. That's to give the appearance of a warrior without any substance behind it. It's about image. It's not about substance for Solomon at this point. And that's significant that they point this out. David didn't have golden shields. David had real shields and real scars from real battles that he engaged in. Solomon is sitting back in his opulence and losing contact with what it is to really live, what it is to live and depend on God. And he's increasing this wealth that God gave him. He's multiplying it, and he's changing it into something else. He's turning it into something that is far more materialistic than his father before him. This is definitely a slide that's taking place here. It's a course that's taking him towards materialism and away from his dependence on God. And so we just keep, you know, he's talking about the horses here, which are really important. Verse 29, and now the chariot that was imported from Egypt cost 600 shekels of silver and a horse 150, and thus through their agents they exported them to all the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Syria. So, you know, we talked about this before. We look at this here, verse 29. He's getting these horses and these chariots imported from Egypt. That explicitly is dealt with in Deuteronomy 17. Moses is talking to the children of Israel. All of a sudden, he starts giving them instructions for a king. You know, they didn't even think about a king at that time. They're thinking, we don't know. We don't know what from kings. But he starts explaining to them what a king should be doing and what a king should not be doing. And one of the things he says, he shouldn't be multiplying silver and gold. And here we see Solomon doing that. The writer of 1 Kings is clearly making this point. He's trying to point this out. It's way too closely connected to Deuteronomy 17. He's trying to get across that something's going wrong here with Solomon. And then this whole thing about the horses in Egypt, and explicitly, this is what God says to him in verse 16 of Deuteronomy 17. Don't go to Egypt to get horses, and don't send your people there to get horses, because you came out of them and you're not going to go back to them anymore. And so here is Solomon defying this very clear command that's been given to kings, and he's defying it. But what's interesting is the last part that's tagged on here, that the horses, thus their agents exported them. And so then all of a sudden you get the idea of how the rationalization would work on this. I mean, surely he would know. Surely the priests would know. Surely somebody would know that he shouldn't be bringing in horses from Egypt. But now they're acting as brokers. They're agents. We're bringing them in from Egypt, but we're not doing it for ourselves. We're just selling them out somewhere else. Defying the spirit of the command, but maybe keeping it to the letter, to that degree, which shows a problem in Solomon's heart. He's rationalizing his move away from God's purposes and plans. He's making up excuses for why it's going to be okay this time. It's going to be all right. And why? For what? For more gold. So that silver is like dirt in the streets. It means nothing. To a man can gain the whole world but lose his soul. And what has he gained? He's gained absolutely nothing. And Solomon is certainly a picture of that. That rationalization to defy God's commands is going to lead to ruin. And we'll see as we get to the next chapter the kind of ruin that it brings for Solomon. So unfortunately, while Israel had a golden age, as I said before, golden ages only last for a short time. There's only one kingdom that will have an eternal golden age. It's been planted in our hearts. It will be established on the earth one day, somehow, whatever it looks like, I don't know. But one day, and its glory will never fade, and its beauty will never end. But in this case, it was a brief moment, a pullback of the curtain to see the kind of splendor and ideal that could be achieved, but it's going to be short-lived. And now we see Solomon from that passage on sliding towards his own oblivion. Does Solomon make it in the end? I don't know. Nobody knows. There's no way of knowing. God's the only one who's in control of that sort of thing. We can't make a judgment on that, but we can learn from his example. We can commit our hearts to following after the Lord. We can commit our hearts to being careful that while he's blessed us with many things, as he has as Americans, we live in a land of plenty. We live in a land where everything is at our fingertips. And especially at this time, during a time where it seems like materialism runs rampant, in a time when it's supposed to be about self-sacrifice and intentional humility, we've got to be careful that we don't take the things that God's blessed us with and turn them into self-serving idols, but rather use those things to glorify him, remain consistent with his will and his purposes. So, Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for the things that we find there. Lord, how often do we come up to your word and scratch at something and suddenly realize there's so much more underneath it, more than we'll ever be able to take in or comprehend in our lifetime. We thank you for your word. It's so wonderful. It's so wonderful. We thank you for your word. And I pray, Father, that you develop that heart that longs for the knowledge that we can gain from this and the knowledge of what it is to be in relationship with you. Lead us through your word, I pray, Father. Do this for us. In Jesus' name, amen.